Morris Boyd. Up next on Think, the case for reforming the Catholic Church by abolishing the Catholic priesthood. We'll spend this hour with writer James Carroll, himself a former priest. Carroll thinks the all-male, celibate, secretive, and deeply hierarchical structure of the Church enables many of its most serious problems: toxic misogyny, protection of sexual abusers at the expense of their victims, and an obsession with status that, in Carroll's words, distorts the gospel's message of selfless love. We'll talk about the often forgotten influence of Roman and European political and social structures that today are ingrained in church culture as if their origins were biblical. And we'll get Carroll's thoughts on how the church might work without clericalism. Our conversation starts after a short break. It made national news last week when police raided the offices of the Catholic Diocese of Dallas, looking for evidence that the church actively protected some priests who'd been accused of sexual abuse. Nearly as disturbing as some of the victims' allegations is the fact that we've grown to expect these stories of a church that appears to sometimes put the interests of accused priests ahead of its obligations to their alleged victims. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Decades of revelations about abuse within the church in Boston, Dallas, Phoenix, L.A., New York, and many smaller cities have left many lifelong Catholics adrift, still connected to their faith, but deeply wary of the institution that administers it. My guest believes the only way for the church to survive may be for Catholics to divest the hierarchy of its unchecked power and take the faith into their own hands. James Carroll is a National Book Award-winning writer and a former Catholic priest himself. His essay, Abolish the Priesthood, appears in the June issue of The Atlantic. He joins us from the studios of WGBH in Boston to talk about it. Jim, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. I'm privileged to be with you.
You open the piece by sharing that the one time you've ever felt relieved that your mother had already died was when the Ryan Commission published its report in 2009 because it would have broken her heart as an Irish Catholic. Remind us of what was in the Ryan Report.
Well, the Ryan Report, which took years to compile, was a court-mandated investigation into institutions that provided shelter, care, housing for children in Ireland throughout the island, well, throughout the Republic part of the island. And most of those institutions are run by the Catholic Church. The Ryan Report found that thousands of children had been abused in one way or another, many of them sexually. It was a grotesque indictment of the institution of the Catholic Church, and it was the beginning of a really quite massive meltdown of Catholic belief in Ireland. It was not published until 2009, I believe, although it had been initiated some years before that. Ireland is ground zero of the collapse of Catholic morality, and you see that played out in the ways in which church attendance, the disappearance of seminaries, the drying up of vocations to the church, this once the very heart of Catholic piety, is now a kind of broken island. And it was when Pope Francis went there last summer and responded to the Irish tragedy, but also to the church's own grotesque disgrace in this era, with bromides expressing shame and sorrow, but not much else. And that's when I realized that the time for my own treating of this as business as usual was over.
The Pope said he had never heard of the Magdalene Laundries before visiting Ireland. Can that possibly be accurate?
Well, Magdalene Laundries, you recall, were those institutions run by religious women, Catholic nuns, to take care of unwed mothers and to be with them as they delivered their children. And one of the scandals of the Irish Church has been the discoveries that the Magdalene Laundries, going back decades, were places of really quite ferocious abuse. And there was a terrible discovery of one institution in particular where the remains of hundreds of infants and young children were found buried haphazardly, some of them even in, I hate to say it, but sewage pits. Hmm. and the scandal of the Magdalen laundries has traumatized the church in a whole other way in Ireland. It was the subject of films and plays. You may have heard of the largely distributed commercial film called Philomena, starring Judi Dench. So it's it was an international scandal, and something in me snapped when I read that Pope Francis, on the airplane back from Ireland to Rome, said to reporters that he had never heard of the Magdalen laundries. He referred to them as laundromats of women. And I first thought the Pope is lying, and then I thought, well, maybe he's not lying, maybe he's just ignorant. But then it hit me that ignorance on such a thing from such a man responsible for the Catholic Church was equally as bad as if he had been lying. There's such a failure of attention, and it epitomized the deflection and the denial that has been at the heart of the Church's inability to respond responsibly to this crisis.
So it's understandable that people outside the Church might ask themselves, is there something wrong with the Catholic faith itself? You're careful in this piece to direct our attention not to Catholic dogma, but to Catholic doctrine. Will you explain the difference?
Well, you know, the Catholic Church is it's a worldwide institution of more than a billion human beings. So everything we say about the human species, we can say about the Catholic Church. So it's flawed the way human beings are flawed. It is capable of reaching the heights of nobility the way human beings are. I loved the line of James Joyce when he defined Catholic as meaning here comes everybody. The Catholic Church is a community of rich and poor, highly educated, illiterate, people of the North, people of the South, high-tech savvy, people who have no relationship to the internet age. It crosses all these boundaries in a way that no comparable institution on the planet does. And that's one of the signals of why it's so precious and worth staying with and fighting for. The Catholic Church has more ability to influence the world for good than any other institution I can think of, just because of its scale and reach. It's the largest NGO in the world. There are more than 150,000 Catholic schools and universities. There are more than 50,000 or 40,000 Catholic hospitals and health centers. All of these places, by the way, run by people who are not priests and bishops, simple Catholics, enacting what we call the corporal works of mercy. And that life of the Church is not, it's not doctrinally obsessed, to get back to your question. It's defined by a huge community of people who simply refuse to let go of the memory of Jesus Christ and what he meant. And down through the centuries, we Catholics have found ways to describe what he meant, which is the source of doctrine. Doctrine developed over centuries, which changes. There are doctrinal claims now being made for the priesthood as if they can't be changed. But one of the things I'm reminding people of is that everything in human life changes, even the Catholic Church. And I'm calling for a profound way in which the institution is organized. And the revelation of the sex abuse crisis is the epiphany that makes that absolutely essential now.
I mentioned in my introduction that you are a former priest yourself. You were ordained by the Paulist Order, served for 5 years, left in 1974. Why did you make the decision to leave the priesthood?
Well, at the time, you know, the truth is, it's only in looking back that I fully understand what was wrong with my life as a priest. I loved being a priest. I was privileged to work with young people at a university. I was the Catholic chaplain at Boston University. It was a privileged time to be a priest, the civil rights movement and the peace movement in their heyday. But there was something wrong. at the heart of it. And it only later became clear to me what. And I'll just lift up the single largest symbol of it, which is the Catholic priesthood is institutionally unjust toward women. And I remember presiding at the Mass as a man, being kind of somewhat uneasy, not uneasy enough, with the fact that women could not stand there and preside at Mass. This was early in my own awakening as a feminist, but by now it's so clear that the misogynist institution of the priesthood, unjust toward women, one of the most important institutions on the planet, and therefore a major obstacle to the full equality of women everywhere, that this is a signal of the deep dysfunction in the heart of the priesthood. And the fact that it's still taken for granted, and that even a revolutionary, humane figure like Pope Francis stalwartly refuses to dismantle the anti-woman, unjust discrimination of the priesthood, is a signal of how deeply, deeply wrong this is. And that's as close to a simple explanation as I can give you.
So I grew up Catholic, spent many, many years in Catholic schools. Therefore, I know that defenders of the church say it doesn't disrespect women. It has created special and kind of sacred roles for them within the faith that are different from the roles reserved for men. You don't buy this.
Well, that reminds me of the old saw about segregated education, separate but equal. That was the phrase used to defend racial segregation in the United States. There's no such thing as separate but equal. It's certainly true that women have played magnificent roles in the church. Some of the great saints, some of the great mystics, religious women, the countless numbers of Catholic nuns who have been the spine of the church. So in a million years, I wouldn't denigrate the contribution of women, the power women bring to Catholic life. But the center of Catholic life is the Eucharist, the sacraments. The center of the Catholic power structure is the priesthood. As long as women are forbidden to be priests, they are marginal to the Catholic imagination, except as servants who are brought in when the men see fit to bring them in. That's wrong. We wouldn't accept this in any other category. If the Catholic Church refused to ordain African-American men, on the basis of what? That Jesus didn't have any African-American apostles? The world wouldn't accept that for a second. In fact, the church wouldn't pretend to promulgate such a position. But that's the moral equivalent of the church's rejection of women for the priesthood. And the fact that that rejection, Chris, is defended by appeals to the choices of his apostles made by Jesus is ludicrous. It's quite ludicrous. And it suggests a scriptural fundamentalism that the bishops who appeal to it don't uphold in any other realm. It would be a little bit like saying we can't not put the Mass in Aramaic, in any language but Aramaic, because that's the language Jesus spoke. Well, of course, no one would say such a silly thing. And the appeal to the all-male character of the apostles is equivalent to that. And by the way, the Gospels emphasize the important role that women played in the central community of Jesus' own life. And there are reasons to think that the person on whom he depended most was a woman, Mary Magdalene, who was the first to see him after the resurrection, the first to preach the good news. The church in subsequent centuries found ways of marginalizing even her by, for example, creating the fiction that she was a fallen woman, a repentant prostitute, and so forth. So the long history of Catholic official power structures denigrating women is at the heart of this dysfunction today.
My guest is writer and former Catholic priest James Carroll. We're talking about his essay, Abolish the Priesthood, which appears in the June issue of The Atlantic. If you'd like to join us, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with National Book Award-winning writer James Carroll about his essay Abolish the Priesthood, which appears in the June issue of The Atlantic magazine. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 800-933-5372. Jim, you argue that the hierarchical structure of the church makes it easy for priests and bishops and cardinals all the way up to obsess over status. First of all, what is the structure of the church based on? What are its origins?
Well, that's a very important question, because the origins of the political structure of the church, the governance of the church, go back to the roots of the church in the late Roman Empire. So the governing structure, for example, the diocese, the idea of the bishop presiding over the diocese with assistants sharing power, that structure was taken from the municipal structures of the Roman Empire in the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries. The structure of the church was solidified when the emperor of the Roman Empire, Constantine, became a Catholic in the early 4th century. And at that point, you get a real solidification of imperial structure of governance in the Catholic Church. A small example of that, or a symbol of it, is the fact that until then, the basilica, which is the perhaps the most common form of large Catholic churches, St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, the basilica was the emperor of the palaces that was the palace of the emperor. And very quickly, within a generation, it became the form of the church building. In the early days of the church, people gathered in their homes. The celebration of what we know as the Mass, the Eucharist, began as a simple meal, bread and wine, in the home. Only gradually did what we think of as the priesthood evolve. It took its form in the 2nd, increasingly 3rd, onto 4th century. The point is, there's nothing wrong with this. It's normal, it's human for the church to take its cultural expression from the broader culture around it. And I take that for granted. In fact, that's at the heart of what I'm calling for. Because just as the early church took its form from the Roman Empire, and then the medieval church took its form from the monarchy of the feudal age, I'm asking the church to take its form today and going forward from the dominant cultural manifestation we know, which is liberal democracy. I'm regarded as a heretic for suggesting that liberal democracy is the answer to Catholic dysfunction now, but it's actually consistent with the long history of the church. So I do foresee a church organized much more fully around democratic norms going forward. Transparency, full accountability, the notion that the power in the church belongs to the people, not to the rulers are servants. And oddly enough, the church had begun to move in this direction in my youth at the Second Vatican Council. You may not be old enough to remember that, Chris, but I'm sure you, as a person growing up in the Catholic world, you had reference to it. The Second Vatican Council from 62 to 65 began this process of recovering from the frozen structure of medieval monarchy and beginning to implement what we would have to call democratic norms. It was short-circuited over this very issue of clerical power. The successors of the prophetic pope, John the 23rd, were in the grip of clericalism themselves, and they shut down the reforms of the Second Vatican Council. And I would say what we're seeing today is a consequence of that shutdown, because clerical power is unchecked, unexamined, is responsible only to itself, and it is always dangerous for those who are powerless, which in our context, terribly, are the young people who've been victimized by priests.
Lots of faiths have, at least until recently, limited their clergy to men. Very few that I know of have asked them to remain single and celibate. How did those things become church policy?
Well, in the beginning, I think, for rather beautiful reasons, people understood, perhaps from the example of monks and hermits, that a completely dedicated life to contemplation, prayer, can be a way of being intimate with the Holy One, with God. That was understood in the beginning as an exceptional call. Gradually, it became extended so that all members of the clergy were expected to be celibate. And it's at that point that something neurotic begins to happen. It doesn't become universally required of the Latin Catholic Church until the Middle Ages, because for very worldly reasons, the church, having come into great wealth and controlling vast stretches of land in Europe, had the problem of the heirs of bishops and abbots claiming inheritance rights over what should have been church property. And the way to short-circuit that, to stop it, was to make all ordained clergy men without families. Therefore, they were required to be celibate. And if they were going to have children from then forward, they would not be recognized legally able to inherit. It's a very worldly reason for the universal rule of celibacy, but it's essential to the history of it. That's how we got here. It's only 1,000 years old, this requirement of universal celibacy in the priesthood. Only 1,000 years old, I say, but that's in church years, makes it relatively young. And that's why it can be changed. I mean, the way to begin the change I'm calling for is very simple, and the Pope has the authority to do it. Welcome married people into the priesthood, and I say people because, secondly, the church should welcome women into the priesthood. Those two acts immediately would change the culture of the priesthood quite dramatically.
What do we know about the ability of priests to keep their vows of celibacy?
Well, we don't know a lot with firm data because, you know, it lives at the level of secrecy. But there have been studies and there are estimates that priests who are human beings, like all of us, and therefore capable of not living up to their ideals or their vows, like all of us, there's no doubt that many priests, in all likelihood, do not find it possible to consistently keep their vows of celibacy. And we know this. We know it from the scandals that have been surfacing. It's also clear from various studies that this requirement of mandatory celibacy for all priests has a negative effect on the culture of the priesthood itself. The ways in which priests are marginal to the experience of full human intimacy, the ways in which priests are marginal to the daily experiences and challenges of family life. Many priests make tremendous lives of generosity and service out of their celibate status. But as we know now all too often, some priests become quite monstrous out of their unhappiness in their celibate status. It's often emphasized that it's only a very small minority of priests who turn out to be predators, and that's quite true. But the real signal of the dysfunction of this culture comes when you match that small number of priests who are predators with the almost entire population of bishops who have been protecting the predators instead of children.
What is the incentive for protecting the predators, Jim?
Well, because the predators, the priests, all have privileged places on what you might call the pyramid of church power, which is presided over by the Pope. And you come down that pyramid, the cardinals and the bishops, and then the pastors, and then the curates, all have their defined place on the pyramid of power. And everyone on the pyramid of power is determined, even if not willfully, but culturally determined, to protect it. And at the bottom of that pyramid, of course, are the lay people. And when someone on the pyramid is behaving disgracefully, criminally even, it isn't that the other people on the pyramid approve of him. No, but his fate threatens theirs, which is why this terrible word scandal has played such a part in this problem. We have to avoid scandal. We have to keep it quiet that Father so-and-so abused an altar boy. We have to move Father so-and-so to another town where there won't be scandal. What is being protected when we move him to another town? The status of the priesthood itself, the dignity and power of the pyramid that has a privileged place for every cleric. That's what's being protected. This is what I mean by clericalism. And it has infected the priesthood itself despite the goodwill of many priests, which is why I'm calling for the abolition of the priesthood itself. It's the only way to uproot this clericalism. So it's, and, you know, it's the way to understand why almost all bishops have been complicit. There's the revelation. And why almost all priests have been at least willing to look the other way. At least willing to look the other way when one of their fellow priests behaves despicably with a minor.
You recount in this piece with great regret, not covering for an abusive colleague when you were a priest, but failing to recognize the signs that he might have been engaging in abuse. Why do you think you didn't recognize those signs?
Well, I'm talking there about Father Paul Shanley, then Father Paul Shanley, who was a Boston priest. I was the Catholic chaplain at Boston University, as I said. He was the Catholic chaplain at Boston State College. We were colleagues. I didn't know him well. We didn't work together, but we were at meetings together. He was much admired. I admired him because he was a famous rescuer of runaways in the late 60s and 70s, early 70s. Runaway children were a big social problem in Boston. It turned out he was raping runaways. Hmm. He was a predator of the first order, and he was exposed by the well-known Boston Spotlight series that generated the film of a couple of years ago, Spotlight. The Boston Globe reporters uncovered the true story of Father Shanley, which was especially egregious because he had been so firmly protected by Cardinal Law, the Archbishop of Boston. It was in a way the tipping point of the scandal. And I knew Shanley. And when I look back on that and realize that I thought well of what Shanley was doing when he was, quote, rescuing young people, I was blind to what he was really doing. I didn't see it. And the truth is I couldn't have imagined it because I was in the grip of an assumption about the superior virtue of priests, I suppose. I was blind to what was real, and I myself, a priest at the time, was therefore manifesting a symptom of this dysfunction I'm calling clericalism. And so, yes, that's part of what haunts me. I'm haunted by my own complicity at the time in the denigration of women by being part of a structure that refused to admit women to equality, and a kind of general participation in that pyramid of power that I was just describing. I left it without fully understanding why. It took me years to look back and see the truth of what I had been doing.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I want to talk about defrocking. Some priests have been punished by the church, not necessarily turned over to the authorities, but have lost their status within the church as ordained priests. What's really interesting is that defrocking is not the same thing as excommunication, right? Which is like the punishment for Catholics outside the clergy who divorce and then remarry. They're not supposed to ever take communion again. It just puts a defrocked priest back at the level of every good lay Catholic showing up for Mass every Sunday.
Yeah, it's true. There's a line in, I think, was it The Godfather, about a criminal who was going to have to go straight, and he said, "Now I'll be a schmuck like everybody else." That's what defrocking means. The priest is a schmuck like everybody else. Although not quite, because, you know, the priest retains his sacred power to bring absolution to someone who's dying. But it's a good example of the assumptions of clericalism. There's a kind of built-in assumption that priests live at a higher order of being. The Catholic Church even talks about the ontological change that happens to a priest when he's ordained. Ontological change means in the very core of his building, of his being, he becomes something else. And to be defrocked is to be, as the operative verb is revealing, is to be reduced to the lay state. The odd thing, of course, is, well, two things. One, there's no mandatory requirement for a predator priest to be reduced to the lay state, which there should be. And there's also no mandatory requirement for a predator priest to be excommunicated. There's no such law. Even while the Catholic Church in its solemn canon law requires or orders the excommunication of a woman who attempts to say Mass. So excommunicate a woman who says Mass, but don't excommunicate a predator priest. There's a further example of the maliciousness of clericalism. And I'm sorry to say that this is still in place as of 2 weeks ago when the Vatican finally issued its major statement of reform that Pope Francis has been shepherding along for the last year. Finally, the Vatican is giving us the Catholic Church's official policy response to the abuse crisis. And in that official policy response, there is no mandate for there is no automatic mandate for a priest, a predator priest, to be removed from ministry permanently. There is no, certainly no mandate for him to be excommunicated. There is no mandated punishment for bishops who cover up for priests. There is no requirement of the church to report to civil authorities when accusations of abuse of minors comes in. So that's where we are today, and it's simply wrong.
My guest is writer and former Catholic priest James Carroll. We're talking about his essay, which will appear in the June issue of The Atlantic, Abolish the Priesthood. We'll be back in 2 minutes. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with writer James Carroll. He's a winner of the National Book Award and, as it happens, a former Catholic priest. He's got an essay in the upcoming issue of The Atlantic called Abolish the Priesthood. If you'd like to join us, you can call 800-933-5372. Let's go first on the phone to Frank in Beaumont. Hi, Frank. Beaumont, Texas.
Hi.
Hi.
Good afternoon, Chris. Good afternoon, Father Carroll. I have a question about what exactly it is that Father Carroll means by abolishing the priesthood. Father Carroll, do you mean that there should be a Catholic Church without priests, or a Catholic Church with the composition of the priesthood reformed such that they would be they could be married, there would be females as well as male priests, or do you advocate for a Catholic Church where everybody is a priest?
Thanks for calling.
Yes, Frank, it's a good question. Thank you for it. What I'm talking, you use this quite pointed phrase, a composition reformed of the priesthood, and that's what I'm talking about. The center of Catholic life will continue to be, as it has been from the beginning, gatherings around the table for the sharing of bread and wine, the Eucharist, offered in the memory of Jesus Christ. That's how he is understood to be present among us in our Catholic faith, a faith we share with most Christian bodies. And I'm absolutely, of course, committed to the permanence of the Eucharist as the center of Catholic life, the center of the Catholic imagination. I'm simply saying that the priesthood as we know it now gets in the way of the proclamation of the meaning of the gospel instead of advancing it. Certainly the ordination of women, the ordination of married people, would change the form of the priesthood we have now. But I'm even going more deeply than that to the notion of ordination, that there are ways in which over the centuries we have taken for granted a structure of power exercised by priests, above them bishops, above them the Pope, that is itself the problem. So I'm not simply saying bring married men and women into this structure of power. I'm saying let's dismantle the structure itself, much in the way in which over recent centuries structures of civic and secular power have been dismantled in favor of what we call liberal democracy. I'm looking forward to values of liberal democracy being enshrined in the life of the church, always centered around the Eucharist, presumably with people serving the community by presiding, perhaps, at the Eucharist. Maybe they'll be known as priests because it's a tremendous and sacred tradition, but they won't be priests in the way that we have priests today. That's what I'm saying.
You say the church hierarchy as it exists today primes priests to feel secretly unworthy of their roles. What do you mean by that, and what are the consequences of that sense of being secretly unworthy?
Well, one of the core mistakes of clerical culture is this notion that by becoming a priest, you become better than other people. You have this, quote, ontological change, unquote, that moves you to a higher order of being. You become, as the tradition says, an alter Christus, an another Christ. One of the justifications for the refusal to ordain women is that priests are other Christs, and as males, they have to stand in for Christ. Priests are Christ, the Son of God, the center of our worship. Priests are alter Christus. Priests are ontologically better than other people. Priests are above the rest. An ideology that does this to the priest condemns him to feel secretly unworthy, because no human being can be set above the human condition like that. So even a man of tremendous virtue, even a saintly man, is vulnerable to secret feelings of unworthiness, of failure, of being flawed. Therefore, not, for example, in a position to criticize a fellow priest whom he suddenly realizes has been behaving abusively to the altar boys in the sacristy. Who am I to judge is a famous statement made by Pope Francis, quite beautiful in the context in which he made it. But there's a way in which the spirit of who am I to judge might infect the entire priesthood in ways that have enabled so many priests, most of them, to look the other way when their fellows behaved like predators.
So I wouldn't push back on your idea of allowing women to be included in the priesthood, because it's right, for the sake of women, it's right, many people believe. But I wonder why you think equality for women within the church would change the culture of the church and potentially fix this problem of really heinous sex crimes being covered up. Why would the inclusion of women in the priesthood make that better by definition?
Well, because it would unpack the denigration of women that is central to the Catholic imagination, which influences not only how we think about the priesthood, it influences how we think about sexuality, about the body, about the roles of men and women generally. It all goes back to a misreading of the book of Genesis, the story of Adam and Eve, famously misread by St. Augustine himself, who saw the disobedience of Adam and Eve in the garden as a sexual sin. It was when Adam and Eve had sexual intercourse that original sin took place. And in that story, Eve is the seductress. Eve is the source of Adam's fall. All human suffering, therefore, is a result of what Eve did with her sexuality. And that theological assertion has been the most powerful theological idea to ever grip the Catholic imagination. And you see its consequences in the neurotic confusion about sexual morality generally that has been a mark of Catholic ethical teaching. You see it in the way in which virginity has been elevated to a higher form of being. The vast majority of Catholic saints were virgins, either men or women. The ways in which the Catholic Church is struggling with, for example, the question of contraception, which is at heart a question of the right of women to be responsible for their own reproductive experience, the way in which the Church has allowed itself to be manipulated in the culture wars over the question of abortion, the confusion and moral teaching of the Church's teaching on abortion, because obviously the most important way to bring down the numbers of abortions is to be a firm advocate of contraception, which the Church isn't. So the Church's teaching winds up, in effect, advocating a condition in which abortions are all too numerous. So there's a general confusion, a moral failure, really, in the Catholic imagination that goes back to its essential denigrating of women. And male supremacy is the operating culture of the Catholic Church. And, of course, the powerful overriding symbol of that is the all-male celibate priesthood.
Do you think St. Augustine, the human, not the canonized figure within the Church, Augustine the person, had just sexual hang-ups?
Well, Augustine was a man of his time. I don't mean to demonize him, but he had, as a young man, been a Manichaean, an ancient philosophy that denigrated human fleshly experience, thought that all virtue was spiritual, therefore the soul is good, the body is bad. That Manichaean philosophy influenced Augustine as a young man, and it continued to influence him when he became the most important theologian of the time. So he was influenced in his understanding of the human condition. He didn't believe in the virtues, the sort of glorious virtues of what God did when God created men and women. In Genesis, there's no more beautiful moment in Genesis than when God creates the man and the woman and rejoices in it. And the way in which the denigration of human sexuality has been a part of not just Catholic but Christian moral thinking for centuries has been one of the tragedies of the Christian world.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Let's go back to the phones now. Michael is calling us from Dallas, Texas. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for calling taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, the backdrop is, of course, the what's going on here in the local diocese. Do you think they have an internal procedural mechanism to address these issues? It's called a personal review board, comprised of the bishop, auxiliary bishop, the chancellor, and two other priests. Do you think it's time to replace or completely abolish that personal review board and be replaced by lay Catholics? I'll take my answer off the air, and thank you so much.
Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you, Michael. This is one of the tip-offs to the power of clericalism, that the bishops continually refuse to yield their power over this crisis to other people who are not bishops. The personnel review board staffed by clergy is the problem. Lay people have not been brought in any meaningful way into the process of examination and reform, even by this grotesque crisis that continues to unfold. And even the recent Vatican promulgation of only 2 weeks ago doesn't do it either. Bishops cannot be trusted to supervise bishops, and bishops who protect and pass along predator priests must be punished, removed from positions of authority, and there need to be structures of accountability and transparency. So I don't know the particular story of what's happening in Dallas, but in dioceses all over this country, civil authorities have found it necessary to intervene again and again and again. In Houston a few months ago, the Texas Rangers raided the archdiocesan offices. That's been happening around the country. Why? because the bishops have so clearly failed. So clearly failed. And there's the tip-off. And I'll repeat a point I made earlier. It's true that a small minority of priests have behaved like predators. But the vast majority of bishops have been their enablers. And that's the signal of the corruption.
You mentioned in the piece that about a year ago, after having been a practicing Catholic, long after you left the priesthood, you stopped going to Mass. And I wonder about how these events, this kind of thinking that the Church needs to reform but hasn't done so, has changed not just your relationship to your faith, but do you believe in the same kind of God you always have?
I do. Well, not always, but as a young man, I was at the mercy of a doom-laden God who was going to send me to hell if I stepped out of line. And I wasn't unusual. It was a common Catholic experience in my generation. And it's not unrelated to what we're talking about, because the antidote to that dread was the priest who could give you forgiveness, who could absolve you. When I was a boy, we used to have a card we'd carry in our wallets: I'm a Catholic. In case of an accident, call a priest, because we didn't want to die without having our sins forgiven, as if God needed a priest there to love us. It was a terrible God. And thank goodness, mostly as a result of the Second Vatican Council, that God no longer operates in the Catholic imagination. But my faith has been constant. My whole life long, even in the era of that God, have felt a close presence of Jesus Christ. And having him in my life as a friend, as an intimate friend, is the defining heart of my faith. And the way it's been made real to me over the years is through the Eucharist, going to Mass, which of course has put me in the presence of priests, many of whom are dear friends of mine. And most of whom I've known are men of tremendous virtue. So it's heartbreaking for me to write an essay that in a terrible way effectively insults them. I understand that. I regret it. But I stopped going to Mass for a simple reason. It was no longer possible for me to treat this as business as usual. And that's the most important way in my own life. It can't be business as usual anymore.
James Carroll is a National Book Award-winning writer and former Catholic priest. His essay, Abolish the Priesthood, will appear in the June issue of The Atlantic. Jim, thanks so much for making time to speak with us.
My privilege, Chris. I wish you well.
You can follow us on Twitter at KERA Think and subscribe to our podcast using your favorite podcast app. Learn about upcoming shows at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.